You are listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 6th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist and I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up.
Wir dürfen Putin nicht auf den Leim gehen, jetzt aufgeregt zu reagieren. Alle möglichen Spekulationen.
Germany's Defense Minister Boris Pistorius warns against falling into Putin's trap by speculating needlessly and splitting NATO. But Pistorius also promises an investigation amid continuing fallout from the release of German military conversations by Russia. After that, we'll look at whether U.S. sanctions on Zimbabwe will have any impact on the country's president. We'll have the latest installment of our series on the disappearance of MH370. And
I'm Monocle's Helsinki correspondent Petri Burtsov, and I'll be talking about NATO's Nordic Response military exercise taking place in northern Norway, Sweden and Finland.
And finally, we'll connect with Monocle's own head of radio, Tom Edwards, who's at the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum in Dubai. That's ahead on The Globalist, live from London. This is The Globalist and I'm Chris Chermak. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Donald Trump appears to have won at least 12 of 15 U.S. states so far in the Super Tuesday contest for the Republican Party's presidential nomination. The U.S. is now backing an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the United Nations Security Council after rejecting three previous resolutions. And Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry has landed in Puerto Rico with gangs back home demanding his resignation. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, it is never a good sign when the leader of a nation is referred to at the start of journalistic broadcasts as a possible security risk. But that is the situation for German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who finds himself in after one of the most embarrassing ever intelligence mishaps for Germany. A 38-minute military conversation about Ukraine was leaked by Russian propaganda site RT because somebody joined the call from an unsecure line. It's all adding to an impression that Scholz's government is careless and not in charge when it comes to policy in Ukraine. Well, I'm joined now by Andrew Bulkley in Berlin. He's the co-founder of 20% Berlin, a newsletter for the capital's foreign population based in the city. Andrew, it is great to have you on the show. We'll get to the impact on allies and Ukraine of all of this, but I wanted to ask you, first of all, how this scandal is playing out in Berlin itself.
I think the biggest problem with this scandal, the leak itself is sort of minor. I think if Russia wasn't already aware of how these weapon systems work, then that's an intelligence problem with Russia. But the biggest problem with this whole thing is, where is Scholz at all? We wouldn't have the scandal if there was any leadership from Scholz generally. I've been living in Berlin since 1998. I've never seen such a weak chancellor. I came here, we had Helmut Kohl, followed by Gerhard Schröder, and then we had, of course, Angela Merkel, and now we have this guy called Scholz, who you just never see. There's no leadership from him. So I think everybody's sort of wondering where Scholz even is.
It's really interesting to put it that way. I mean, I wonder if that makes, though, Scholz a security threat as he's being described right now. I mean, the way you characterize all that, the intelligence leak was extremely embarrassing. But how has this fed into the general narrative about Olaf Scholz himself?
Yeah, just that he doesn't play a very leading role and that he's not doing enough. He's not proactive enough on Ukraine. He sort of waits for everybody else to make a decision. And then he follows suit. We had this with the Leopard tanks last year where Ukraine needed the tanks. Germany was sending 20, 30-year-old technology to Ukraine that it just didn't want anymore. Some of it didn't work. And they needed new tanks. And Scholz just didn't do anything until America decided, oh, we'll sell tanks. And Scholz said, oh, I guess we'll sell tanks then after all. And so, again, we have Scholz just sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. And now we find out that he's there. That they're leaking intelligence, that Germany's seen as this big, efficient, secure country, and now we're finding out, well, they're kind of Keystone Cops, really. They, you know, some guy can just join a discussion among generals wargaming a bridge in Crimea, and Scholz is saying, oh, we can't sell these weapon systems to Ukraine because then our soldiers will be just as involved as British and French troops are, which, you know, you don't want to be leaking movements of other countries' troops.
Well, and just on this intelligence scandal itself, I mean, as you say there, it could have been so easily avoided if somebody just knew how to join a secure call. But what is the investigation into this leak likely to find out? I mean, when you say Keystone Cops, I mean, is there a worry here that this is actually a common practice, that there could have been many military conversations that could have been leaked if Russia wanted?
I think that's known. I don't think this is the only thing Russia could have leaked. They found out pretty quickly that the general joined the wrong. He used an unsecure communication channel when he shouldn't. He should have been using a secure channel. So I don't know that you can go much further than to find out that this one general made a mistake. It's already been cleared up. But I think everybody, if you're paying attention, everybody knows that Russia probably has far more conversations that they could leak if they want to. It was just perfectly timed. Scholz made a dumb statement about these weapon systems, and then Russia said, oh, well, we can use this. We'll release this discussion they had about attacking us. So it looks like Germany is ready to start World War III, and Russia is the innocent in this game. It's just Russia's a very adept at propaganda. We've known that for decades, and this is just Russia weaponizing information it already had. And I don't think anybody's surprised that Russia has this information. So I don't think it's a major scandal here. Germany is just embarrassed. There's bigger domestic issues at the moment, so this is just kind of a distraction for people inside Germany. They aren't worried about Germany's face to the rest of the world because of it.
Well, when it comes to that face to the rest of the world, I mean, this is particularly a fight with France and the UK, also because, of course, France's president Emmanuel Macron has not ruled out boots on the ground and called anyone who rules it out cowards. I mean, did Olaf Scholz take that kind of comment personally? What is this doing to the relationship with France?
Well, Germany and France have this traditionally very strong relationship. This has more to do with how France is viewing the war in Ukraine and how Germany is viewing the war in Ukraine. You know, we all know Germany's history. Germany does not want to be seen as a warmonger. And Scholz is actually very worried. He's been open about it, about Putin and his nuclear weapons. And so that's the direction Scholz wants to take, is appeasing Putin. And Macron wants to take a more aggressive stance and say, hey, Putin, be careful. We're not afraid to get involved. It's just a difference in the way the two leaders are viewing the war and how they want to be seen, their approach to the war. Germany and France's relationship is not going to really be that much affected by it.
Well, and when it comes to those two approaches, what does the German public think? As you said, it's not necessarily the biggest scandal in Germany right now. Is that partly because the German public does actually favor a more cautious approach when it comes to Ukraine, both for its history, but just in general as well?
Yeah, definitely. The biggest thing Germans fear is change. And they want everything to just be like it is today. They want it to be that way tomorrow. And, you know, a war is a major change. Of course, what I think Scholz is forgetting, or what the German public is forgetting, is detente. And I think that's what Macron is playing at, is that you have to do a lot of saber rattling to get Putin to stay where he is, because Putin is, of course, a huge Soviet fan. He would love to have the Soviet Union back. And so Macron is just playing the Cold War game of detente. Scholz is trying to be a little more progressive and trying to be wary of what Russia's role in the world is today. And I think the German public is as well, is let's just stay out of this. Let's just not cause too big of waves, and we can worry about other things. There's also a problem in Germany that you have the former Eastern German states who are kind of they back Putin. They are in support of Russia and less of Ukraine. So you kind of have to play this weird balancing game to make sure that the current coalition, the current government, the current feeling in Germany is still, everybody's still together.
Well, and at the same time, though, when you mention that, I mean, Germany is the largest provider of military aid to Ukraine in Europe after the United States. I mean, is there any frustration in the other direction in Berlin that they're held to a sort of higher standard than, say, France?
I think the sense of Germany is more that it's a group project. One of the big policy decisions that Scholz actually did make, surprisingly, was when he came out and said, we're actually going to increase our
military budget and spend hundreds of millions on military equipment, on defense equipment. We're going to make the 2% GDP contribution that NATO demands of us. And so I don't think the public is wary, as public as knows about Germany's, the size of Germany's contribution to Ukraine. Germany thinks we're all in this together, EU-wide, and it's not about Germany being attacked from its allies.
Now, Andrew, just to focus a bit on the domestic side, I mean, this does not come at a good time for the German coalition government in general. They're also facing never-ending strikes in Germany at the moment, public transport, aviation, all of that. I mean, could this break them?
The coalition really isn't at risk, partly because Scholz is so weak. It's hard to attack him. He hasn't done anything. What are you gonna have a no confidence vote for about somebody who there's nowhere to connect that no confidence vote? And the alternative is also a little bit scary. Germany, like most European countries, is moving to the right. If this coalition fails, then it's obviously going to be a very conservative coalition, and it would be hard for that coalition to even find partners without allowing the far right AfD, almost a Nazi party, really, into the government. So the alternatives are too bleak. You have to stay with this coalition. I think we just need more leadership from Scholz, especially on these strikes. Scholz has been silent on these strikes. The Deutsche Bahn, they're going on a 35-hour strike Thursday, which it's almost weekly at this point, and he hasn't said anything. He hasn't offered any contribution. So I don't think that the coalition, I don't think the government's at risk. We just need something more from Scholz.
Well, so if the coalition itself is not at risk, just finally, is there anybody else, though, that might be stepping into the void when you describe Olaf Scholz the way that you do, from the other parties, Christian Lindner of the Free Democrats, Robert Habeck of the Greens, or Annalena Baerbock of the Greens? I mean, are others trying to step up and fill that void?
That's part of the problem, really, is, in fact, Baerbock and Habeck, the Greens, they're very, very present. They're way more present than he is. But they're also from a former sort of a splinter party, an extreme party, the Greens, focused on environmental. So that's divisive, because everybody says, well, that's a minority party. Where's our big leader? You have Lindner, FDP, the finance minister, who really doesn't do much other than say, we're not spending more money. That's all he really does. So yeah, you have these three ministers who seem like they're the government. They seem like they're the chancellor rather than the actual real chancellor.
Andrew Bulkley there. Thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist.
What kind of city do you want to live in? Every week on The Urbanist, we delve into the biggest questions about urban living and meet the people championing change in our cities. From Starkitects to Designosauruses, protected views to landfills, river walks and sidewalks, wayfinding and cycle highways, the city is alive and kicking. So how can we make them better places to live in?
The other great city creation, of course, is sex. Young people go to cities to have a good time and to enjoy themselves and to meet their life partners and maybe a few other people on the way.
Join me, Andrew Tuck, every Thursday at 2000 hours London time for a brand new episode. Or subscribe to the podcast and listen as you go. The Urbanist, the show that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
It is 9:13 in Harare and 7:13 here in London. To Zimbabwe now, which faces a fresh round of sanctions from the United States. The U.S. Treasury Department has targeted a series of companies and individuals tied to Zimbabwe's president, who they accuse of both corruption and human rights abuses. U.S. officials insist they're not targeting the people of Zimbabwe, but whether they'll really have any direct impact on the country's leadership is also an open question. Well, I'm joined by Tara O'Connor, founder and executive director of Africa Risk Consulting, a Pan-Africa consulting company. Tara, let's start with the cause here before we get to the sanctions. What is the president accused of?
Well, he's really accused of running a criminal network that of government officials and business people that are involved in corruption, but also in human rights abuses against the people of Zimbabwe.
And what are the latest sanctions sort of expected to do about that? How do they fit in with previous rounds?
Well, the previous rounds, what's very interesting about this is that the previous round of sanctions have all been scrapped. A lot of them were seen by many people as dead wood, not really enforceable. There were still sanctions, for example, imposed against the late President Robert Mugabe. And so those have been lifted. And really, what the new sanctions is very much focused on the President Emmerson Mnangagwa, his wife, his key political, his key business allies, and the key elements of the security state that have been responsible for some serious human rights abuses, particularly around the last elections, that led to some people, opposition people, being abducted and indeed murdered. So this is an update. It's also an extension. It comes under the global Magnitsky sanctions, which are much tougher and which have a global reach. And so I think they are likely to be more effective getting rid of the old sanctions, deadwood, and actually repurposing and refocusing the sanctions anew.
If they are likely to have more of an effect this time around, then how is the Zimbabwean government and the president reacting?
Well, I think certainly the people around the president have reacted in kind of shock and disappointment. On Twitter, formerly Twitter X, the president's spokesperson was a little bit initially thought that this was a victory for Emmerson Mnangagwa, who, along with a number of African leaders, have been pushing the Biden government to actually lift sanctions. And so sanctions were lifted again against a number of people who are no longer part of the ruling ZANU-PF group, but they have doubled down on the leadership.
So if they've doubled down on the leadership, as you described there, I mean, what do you expect the impact to be in terms of the leadership and President Mnangagwa? I mean, could he face challenges from other members of the government? I mean, is there any chance that he might change policy to some degree based on these sanctions?
Well, knowing the situation and having followed Mnangagwa for many years, I don't think it will change his, it won't necessarily change what he does. But it will challenge the people that enable. I mean, one of the reasons that the sanctions has been imposed is that Mnangagwa is believed to be at least facilitating, but possibly overseeing a massive gold and diamond smuggling operation out of Zimbabwe to Dubai. And it will give people pause, people in Dubai, the enablers, the people who actually support the trafficking of gold, illicit trafficking of gold and so on. It will give them pause before they actually provide services to the elite clique. So that will definitely have an impact. It may actually indeed have an impact on his ability to be able to pay the army and so on, and pay the key people around him. And if that is the case, it will put pressure. It will put clear pressure on the regime in Zimbabwe. But I suspect for the moment, it will be ignored, and there are sufficient enablers around him that will probably will continue to support him.
It is interesting, just to follow up on that, the way you describe that gold and diamond illegal trade. I mean, that's something the president has been able to get around sanctions on before and basically finance his government through that illegal trade. Is it your sense that these sanctions really will have a different kind of impact, that they're able to target that illicit trade directly?
Well, most of the illicit trade is through Dubai. And I think probably, Dubai is very cautious about its reputation to try and avoid getting a reputation as a money laundering center. And so I think probably, definitely there will be second thoughts, people that are actually, and again, in South Africa, where a lot of, where Emmerson Mnangagwa and his family members are likely to be able to travel to and to own properties and all of that will become very difficult. Anywhere where Mnangagwa has to use a bank account or anything like that, or any member of his wife or his immediate entourage will now be basically excluded from international banking, banking with with reporting relationships with any US bank, for example, will now not be able to do any business with them whatsoever.
And Tara, perhaps just finally, you do mention there that these sanctions are specifically designed to target the leadership, as you lay out, the president and his wife and his bank accounts and all of that. It's not aimed at the people of Zimbabwe. That's what the U.S. obviously says. But is that really possible? I mean, do you expect that this will have an impact on the people of Zimbabwe as well, the way you suggested perhaps before? If the president can't get as much money, he's still going to try and pay the military over his people first.
Yes, absolutely. The real key to staying in power is the fact that Mnangagwa has been able to pay the military to stay in power. And this will now make that more difficult for him. But it is very clear that the real problem for ordinary Zimbabweans is the ZANU-PF government. ZANU-PF government have, and by their economic policies, by the extensive corruption, by actually inverting the country's economy to be a corrupt state capture organization from which really only the elite benefit, you've seen millions of Zimbabweans being forced to leave the country to find work elsewhere. So I none of the sanctioned companies of the past have really had the interests of the Zimbabwean people at heart. So this is very clear. These new sanctions with this new global element really is very focused. And it's a clear message as well to the Zimbabwean people that it's the leaders that are being targeted and not them.
Tara O'Connor, thank you very much for joining us. Still to come in the program.
Well, I joined a website which was devoted to the search of MH370. And the work we did was actually recognized in the official report.
We'll talk to Richard Godfrey, a founding member of the independent group investigating the disappearance of MH370 10 years ago this week. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me right here in the studio is Claudine Fry, partner at Control Risks. Good morning, Claudine.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Let's start with Egypt, a big major economic crisis for Egypt that is leading people to buy and sell gold.
That's right. This is a piece from the New York Times entitled "Egyptians are buying and selling gold just to stay afloat." I think we've seen gold just this week hit a record high. It is playing its usual role of being a port in a storm during times of turbulence. And Egypt is, as you mentioned, yes, going through a serious financial crisis. Inflation hit a record high of 38% back in September and it has edged down only marginally since then. It's been struggling to get foreign exchange and it's been hit most recently as well. By a loss of revenue that it would normally earn through shipping in the Red Sea, which of course has been disrupted in connection with violence going on in Israel and Hamas. So people in Egypt have been looking for safe havens for their cash, and gold has been one of them. But as the report notes, even the value of gold has been uncertain and fluctuating recently.
It is It is interesting, just the fact that, as he mentioned, things like the Red Sea there, just the impact that the crisis in Gaza, the war in Gaza, the Red Sea, all of this is having on these neighbours, countries like Egypt.
That's right. Egypt's certainly one of the countries that should be watched very closely in terms of the impact of that crisis in Israel and Gaza and the potential much wider consequences of that. Egypt is on the cusp of securing a large, very large loan from the IMF. It has also secured just recently a very large deal with the United Arab Emirates, which has committed to spending $35 billion developing a new city and tourism destination. The IMF is probably going to be providing in the region of about $8 billion, which is huge. And I think this points to the strategic significance of Egypt and concern in many quarters to avoid the crisis there spreading.
Well, let's focus on another international financial institution, the European Central Bank. You brought us a story from the Financial Times about a really interesting and kind of bizarre, frankly, revolt of the staff over the board's disrespectful approach to climate change.
That's right. This is a piece in the FT entitled ECB Sparks Staff Revolt Over Board's Disrespectful Approach to Climate Change. The Financial Times says it's seen a letter produced by a staff committee at the European Central Bank complaining actually about the use of language by leadership and specifically by a board member at a recent meeting who was reported to have said that the bank would not want to hire people who have to be, quote, reprogrammed because of what they might think on climate change. I think the staff was specifically raising an issue about democratic values and culture within the organisation, not necessarily questioning the positioning on climate change itself. But the piece tells us that morale in the bank is perhaps low, and more than half of staff who responded to a recent survey felt that the president, Christine Lagarde, was performing poorly. The bank has taken a robust and pretty strong position on climate change, and that's included the board member in question, who has been very vocal on where he thinks the bank should be positioning itself on the issue.
It is very interesting, exactly that, isn't it? That normally we have stories about, frankly, institutions that are not doing enough about climate change. Here we have this story about an institution that is perhaps not doing too much, or at least it's the board. It's a board member who is using this disrespectful language to kind of lay into his colleagues that they are not focusing enough on climate change.
Yeah, that's right. It is really unusual we see it this way round, isn't it? But I think it's an illustration of just how delicate this issue is. I think we're going to increasingly see this challenge between what is democratic and representative to do on climate change and what leadership in state and non-state institutions and organisations needs to do and perceives that they need to do to push forward on adaptation.
Well, let's move on to one other story. I mean, Taylor Swift is always in the news, and she is once again for a concert in Singapore. How has this been playing out?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm not sure we need more news on Taylor Swift, do we? But I thought this was a striking example in the Straits Times of how Swiftonomics really does touch every corner of the globe. There's a meeting taking place this week in Melbourne, in Australia, of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, a group which has often been criticised in the past for being a bit more talking shop than action house. It has a lot of meaty issues on the agenda there this week, including the state of humanitarian affairs in Myanmar and the nature of the group's relationship with China and the situation in the South China Sea. But even in ASEAN, even in that group at the press conference, Taylor Swift made an appearance. The Singapore Prime Minister was asked about reports that Singapore had done a deal with Taylor Swift and agreed to pay a significant amount of money in return for Taylor Swift agreeing not to perform in other parts of the region. She's there this week and is therefore not appearing in other parts of the region, including Thailand, the Philippines, for example.
Do we imagine that this was something that was part of sort of backdoor negotiations behind the scenes at ASEAN? Were other leaders also raising this with the Singapore PM and saying, how dare you take Taylor Swift away from us?
I think so. But at least some of them have been very careful to be diplomatic about the issue publicly. But I think behind the scenes, yes, there's been quite a bit of frustration. And as the Singapore Prime Minister said, they weren't behaving in an unfriendly way. But nonetheless, clearly It's each one to their own, and there is a lot of competition for visitors, for tourism, and for that dollar associated with the presence of Taylor Swift.
Well, just finally, Claudine, before we let you go, you found one story about the rise of tooth jewellery. This is not something I'd heard of before.
No, me neither. I'm not familiar with tooth jewellery, but apparently it's a thing. Yes, there's a piece in The Guardian here in the UK about the fact that tooth jewellery is having a moment. People are spending sometimes quite enormous amounts of money on having tiny jewels attached to their teeth, or what are called grills, which are basically bracelets that sit across a number of your teeth. It's a way, apparently, of being able to express your individuality and your personality. And it seems to have become a lot more popular post-pandemic, as we've all become much less formal at work. And there is a degree of less, a bit more relaxed, I think, about how we look at work, at least in many environments. There's also been a huge surge in all types of dental procedures in the wake of what the article notes as the Zoom boom, when we've all been spending a lot more time on virtual calls, and a need to really up our game in terms of how we look from our shoulders up.
Whoever knew that teeth jewellery would be an informal way to express yourself. Claudine Fry, thank you very much for joining us. Now here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Donald Trump appears to have won 13 of 15 U.S. states in the Super Tuesday contest for the Republican Party's presidential nomination, with rival Nikki Haley capturing a surprise lone victory in the state of Vermont. Joe Biden is also maintaining a firm lead on the Democratic side. The U.S. is now backing an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, together with the release of all hostages. At the United Nations Security Council, it has revised language in a draft resolution to that effect, after rejecting the word ceasefire in three previous resolutions. And Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry has landed in Puerto Rico, unable to return home after gangs in the country orchestrated a prison break over the weekend and have demanded his resignation. Haiti has been in a state of emergency since Sunday. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now it is time for the latest installment of our series on the disappearance of MH370. Today we hear from Richard Godfrey, a founding member of the so-called independent group of experts who banded together in the days, weeks and months after Malaysian Airlines MH370's disappearance to try and help authorities find out what the heck happened. Richard Godfrey spoke to me about his motivations for getting into this search in the first place. It's a story that takes us back to the disappearance of yet another plane.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9, right?
It goes back to 2009, 5 years earlier than the disappearance of MH370. I was working in Brazil, and I was booked on Air France 447 from Rio to Paris with an onward connection to Frankfurt. I had to rebook 2 weeks later from Sao Paulo direct to Frankfurt on Lufthansa and stay in Brazil on business. But when I heard that Air France 447 had crashed in the Atlantic, I thought to myself, there but for the grace of God go I. So when I heard about the crash of Air France 447, I followed the search, the reports, and when MH370 happened, I saw immediately the parallels of losing a large modern airliner in the middle of, this time, the Indian Ocean, not the Atlantic. So I immediately got involved with MH370 and got into following that, and I've been following it for the last 10 years.
And there are so many players involved in this mystery of MH370's disappearance, as you lay out there in part with the dueling press conferences or the many press conferences, but also just so many theories about where it may have gone. When did you decide that you might have something very real to contribute to all of that?
Well, I joined a website run by a friend of mine called Duncan Steele, which was devoted to the search of MH370. And I immediately found that I had a role to play, and there was a small group of people who eventually became known as the independent group because they were not part of the official search. But the work we did was actually recognized in the official report. I'm named in the official report from ATSB with thanks and acknowledgement of my contribution. So this group, I think, had quite some influence on the search. We asked the hard questions.
If you are onto something, as you suggest, perhaps just remind us or tell our listeners where your current best guess is as to where the crash site is, and whether you believe there's a possibility that a search could be restarted once all of this academic work is done.
The crash location we have identified is at 29.128 degrees south, 99.934 degrees east. It's within a circle with a radius of 30 kilometers. This is an area of the Indian Ocean about 1,500 kilometers west of Perth in Australia. And there are a number of people interested in going back out and searching again. Ocean Infinity, Deep Sea Vision, another American company run by a former head of Google Engineering. And I'm in regular contact with all of these people, and they all express an interest to go back out. Some need the permission of Malaysia because they want a compensation if they find MH370. Others are willing to fund it themselves, so they don't need permission to go and look and find. They need permission if they're going to salvage anything, which is a different story. But I think if you find it and you publish some pictures or some video of MH370, then the Malaysian authorities will hardly turn down an offer to help salvage things like the black box and so on.
What do you imagine that moment would be like if we ever do actually find MH370?
Well, I think it means a lot to a lot of different people in different ways. To the families, I think it will help bring closure. To the flying public, there are 10 million of us who get on a plane every day. It'll give us a bit more confidence that when we get on a plane, we're going to arrive where we say. To the aviation industry, it will close this particular investigation and enable us to learn some lessons out of MH370. Currently, we do not know exactly what happened and why. So we need to learn those lessons for the future of aviation.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Right.
That was Richard Godfrey. You can hear a full interview with Richard and other experts in a special series on MH370's disappearance being published as a Monocle weekly special on Friday's anniversary. You're with Monocle Radio. It is coming up on 9:38 in Helsinki and 8:38 in Zurich. Since Sunday, the Western Military Alliance, NATO, has been involved in a set of military exercises with the Nordic nations of Finland, Sweden, and Norway. For Finland, which of course shares a border with Russia, it marks the first time that they've participated as a fully fledged NATO member. And to tell us more, I'm joined by Petri Burtsov, Monocle's Helsinki correspondent. Petri, great to have you on the show. Let's just start with how big a moment is this for Finland?
Good morning, Chris. It is a big moment. As said, it's the first time that Finland participates in a NATO, in a large-scale NATO exercise as a full-fledged member of the alliance. And not only that, but Finland also participates with a largest ever contingent that it has sent to any foreign or multinational military exercise, sort of reflecting the importance of this exercise. And I mean, in very practical terms, for Finland and the Finnish troops, there are there is a lot to practice. Finland has taken part in these exercises before. Two years ago, the same exercise was called cold response. I was actually there reporting for Monocle, and I remember speaking with the Finnish troops there. So they've always been there, or for a long time at least. But now this is the first time that they're under NATO's command structure. So there's a lot to practice. They're going to practice also the sort of the switch over from being under the Finland's own command structure into switching under NATO's command structure, and other considerations as well when different nations try to fight together.
Well, I wonder how does that change the symbolism? I mean, there's two sides of this, right? There's the tactical side of just being under NATO's command structure, but there's also the symbolism of what that means, right? The fact that if there is some kind of war breaking out, you are under NATO's command. You're not fighting for yourself anymore. Is that something that perhaps in previous exercises or in general, Finland was preparing to maybe fight for itself?
Yes, Finland has always being prepared to fight for itself, and it still does, but now the difference is, as you mentioned, it's now under the NATO's deterrence umbrella and will be assisted by other members. But yeah, I think for Finland, the participation, I mean, Finland has been a very close sort of partner of NATO, even without having been a member, and it's been all about sending a signal to Russia, sending a message basically saying that, this is how close we are to NATO. But now, of course, things are different. Finland is a full-fledged member, and I like the fact how they. I think it's interesting they changed the name from, as I said, from Cold Response to Nordic Response, to sort of reflect the fact that now all the Nordic countries, I mean, Sweden set to join any day now, are in NATO, and changing the name also sends a big signal.
Well, Finland is really leaning into this at the moment, isn't it? I mean, you did say there's a lot to practice, but there is, they're engaged in over 100 multinational military exercises this year. What are they trying to figure out?
I think it's twofold, I think. One is, of course, as I said, sending a message that, we have partners, we are training with them, they want to train with us. We've seen a lot of American soldiers train in Finland. There's been pretty much a permanent presence of American soldiers ever since Finland joined, training all over Finland. So it's partly about, as I said, sending this message, but then also, the fact that we have one of the largest, I mean, if you count the reserves, we have one of the largest land forces in Europe. So, for decades they've been learning to fight just by themselves, and now they have to fight alongside others. So, that's also partly what all the exercises are about. We just have to learn to speak a common language, both in very practical terms, quite literally speaking a common language, but then also how we fight together.
And given that, then I wonder how big a shift in Finnish military culture is this in your mind? How difficult will this be for them if they are used to more working under their own command and now having to shift to working for somebody else?
I mean, to be honest with you, Chris, it's quite a large shift. I've seen some of the because we have mandatory military service, and they've actually started to change that mandatory service also so that it reflects Finland's membership in NATO and the fact that you have to speak languages and work with others. So it's a very, very big change. But let's not forget that even as NATO members, every NATO member is still in charge of defending its own territory. But I think one thing that we have to remember about this exercise now taking place in northern Norway, Sweden, and Finland is that NATO at the Vilnius summit last summer agreed on these new territorial defense plans. So remember, in the past, sort of the NATO plans for its eastern flank were based on what some researchers called this tripwire approach. Basically, that we have a deterrence, we have some battle groups in the east, but it's still based on the fact that maybe we might lose these territories and then we have to regain them. But they changed that into defending them. They now believe that that we have to we have to not only deter, but we have to defend every inch of the NATO territory, as Stoltenberg said. So, you know, this is, it's quite a big change, and there's a lot to practice to be able to actually fight a defensive war together.
Well, and also exactly as you mentioned there, I mean, this is about defending NATO's territory, which means, though, not just NATO's border in Finland with Russia, but also, you know, before Finland wouldn't have gotten involved if, say, Russia attacked Estonia. That's a change, too. How is that perceived in Finland?
If looking at it, actually, let's start from the Estonian side. So they were one of the biggest proponents of Finland's membership because, I mean, Finland's border starts just north of NATO. So they always felt a little bit at risk when Finland was not in NATO. So Estonia thought it was extremely important that Finland join. And now, of course, Estonia is following this exercise very keenly. Estonia and the other Baltic countries are not taking part themselves in this exercise. They have their own exercises, but they really do want to see. Estonia was one of the biggest lobbyists for this territorial defense plans that I just mentioned. So they're really following with a keen eye how that works in practice when the states in the north practice.
Petri, thanks very much. That was Petri Bertsov. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
This is The Globalist, and I'm Chris Chermak. Time for a roundup of news from the transport sector. I'm joined now from Stockholm by Gabriel Lee, Monocle's transport correspondent. Gabe, we'll start with American Airlines. They've been placing a massive series of orders for planes.
Right, yeah. American doing this blockbuster order for, I think it's 260 aircraft solid, and then options for more. And what's interesting about it is that they've ordered from basically every major manufacturer, the big ones anyway, Airbus, Boeing, and Embraer. And of course, they've signed on for 85 of the troubled 737 MAX, the 10 version, which it actually isn't certified yet. So there's a lot to look at in that big order.
There's a huge amount to look at. What's kind of motivating this? I mean, is American Airlines doing that well?
I think, yes, the short answer is American Airlines is doing well, and, you know, profits are up, traffic is up, demand is very high, and also the order books are full. So an airline as big as American, which is the largest in the world by most metrics, is going to be looking to secure slots in deliveries many years down the line. If they don't do it now, they might find themselves in trouble 5, 6, 7 years down the line.
And, I mean, the fact that they're going for all of these different companies, the fact they're even going with Boeing and the MAX, what does that say to you?
Well, that's also a reflection of the fact that an airline that big really needs to order from everyone. So, you know, the smaller airlines can say, okay, we're going to be all Airbus or we're going to stick with the smaller Embraer. But really, American, in order to get the planes it needs in time, considering what's happening now with the heavily booked up order books, with supply chain issues that are persisting, you know, American is going to order from every single one. And you know, with the 737 MAX, that aircraft, like I mentioned, is not even certified yet. They will no doubt have gotten assurances from Boeing that, you know, there are options. If that one doesn't work out for whatever reason, they can change to another aircraft. And probably they have some financial arrangement in terms of if there are more delays, which could very well happen.
Well, Gabriel, as you say, they are diversifying. But let's move on to another story about one plane maker that they are not buying from, and that's from China. The Comac C919 has been making its way around Southeast Asia. China's looking for buyers outside of China.
Right. This is such an interesting one because basically Comac, the maker of this C919, which is a very close, would-be competitor to Airbus and Boeing's narrow-body aircraft, They kicked things off at the Singapore Air Show a couple of weeks ago, and now they're taking it around Southeast Asia. They see this as probably their best bet early on to try and sell this aircraft outside of China. They have had some small sales of, especially of a sister aircraft, the ARJ-21, in countries around Asia, but very, very little. And in many cases, this aircraft that COMAC are creating that are, you know, it's brand new also, but they are not certified to fly in most countries, and especially not Europe and the US. So it's a long road for them to sort of gain a foothold in the way that Boeing and Airbus have now. But they are starting that process, and they're investing heavily in this process. That China is very serious about being a competitor in this space. It's not going to happen right away, but it's interesting to watch.
And what is your sense of how successful they could actually be on this, whether they will gain buyers outside of China? I mean, we've done also on this show before BYD when it comes to electric vehicles, for example, taking Europe now by storm. Could that be down the line?
Right. I mean, there are a lot of factors here. I mean, you look at, you know, a lot of this is a big, it's a political question, right? So there's politics in the mix. But if we look separate from the politics, you could imagine that China could price these very attractively. So if we see that they are reliable, that they do what they need to do, that they're not out of service 40% of the time, which is probably a fear among many Western airlines, if we see that they are reliable in the same way that Airbus and Boeing are, that it could become interesting over time if the political thing moves as China would like it to, and if those planes get certified. And also going back to the previous point about there just aren't that many spots in order books. Airlines at the moment need more aircraft. There is room in the world for more than just Airbus, Boeing, and a little bit of Embraer on the side. So, you know, we need more aircraft basically at the moment, and it could be that could work in China's favor basically.
Well, let's move on to another story. SAS is exiting Chapter 11, and they're going to be joining SkyTeam as part of the Air France KLM group.
Right. This is a big shakeup for SAS and SAS's frequent flyers, because SAS is one of the founding members of Starlines, which obviously, you know, counts many of the Central European airlines as members, and sort of this big stake being taken by Air France KLM. They're saying that SAS will join that group, the AF KLM group. Still a lot of unanswered questions about what that means for SAS in terms of its network, in terms of Eurobonus, its miles program, you know, what happens there. Some people are upset to lose that access to Starlines, but it is probably a good move for SAS itself, and they'll be no doubt happy to be sort of exiting this period, hopefully towards a bit more profitability, a bit of a chance to work together with SkyTeam to improve the profitability, which they've had a lot of trouble with. Especially, they'll probably be looking forward to joining what they say they want to join, the transatlantic joint venture, which means they can sort of coordinate fares with other SkyTeam airlines across the Atlantic, which they don't have in Star Alliance at the moment. So interesting times for SAS, and a lot of people that are frequent flyers of them, including myself, wondering what will happen exactly with the network and more.
Are you looking forward to simply the fact that they've exited Chapter 11? I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to see them go back to a kind of a bit more of a growth mindset, not just sort of slashing costs and feeling a little more confident and taking part in a little bit of this boom that other airlines are, you know. So I'm hopeful that they can return to a sort of a positive place, because at their best, they are a good airline and they are useful for us in Scandinavia. So.
Well, just quickly and finally, Gabriel, British Airways is also making a variety of new investments in new short-haul seats and updating its long-haul for that matter.
Yeah, that's right. So this will be probably good news for most passengers flying British Airways. The short-haul fleet is getting new seats, which is obviously nice. They're also putting back, if anyone's flown Club Europe before, they used to have a little tray table blocking the middle seat that goes empty in those cabins in business class within Europe. They removed that for a while, and it just looks nicer with the little extra tray there, and you can put your drink there. So people will be happy about that. Also notable is that they are redoing their first class, their long-haul first class, starting with the A380s. So that's interesting, because many airlines have done away with first class. British Airways obviously still feels they can sell this and it's worth investing in. And also the A380 is an aircraft that was sort of thought pretty much dead a few years back, and now is really having its comeback. So it's nice to see those get invested in as well to get new onboard products.
Interesting. Leaning into the A380. Gabriel Lee, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist on Monaco Radio. And finally, on today's show, we head to Dubai and the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum. That's where Monocle's team has been busy hosting and visiting panels and presentations. And I can say that I'm joined now from Dubai by Monocle's head of radio, Tom Edwards. Tom, it sounds busy over there, I'm getting the sense, or I'm hearing from our producers. What is this Sustainable Cities about?
You can probably hear the sound of birdsong as well, Chris. We're out on one of the lovely shaded terraces here at Expo City Dubai. I can put you in the picture, Chris. Also, thanks to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, who's alongside me, Andrew. What is the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum all about, and what are we doing here?
Well, I guess it's the in action bit that is interesting, because there's lots of conferences that look about sustainability, and even that very word has got a bit abused over time. But Dubai is always interesting because it uses its position to bring in people from the global south. So its very position in the world means that if you're connecting from Asia or Africa, it's an easy place to get to. And also the UAE is having close relationships with many of those countries as well. So Monocle was invited to run what they call a majlis, which is a traditional, essentially it's a kind of sitting room, a gathering space that people have in their homes here. But they did a version on stage where they invited a world panel and also a female-led panel to talk about issues of sustainability. And amazingly, Monocle was asked to host those with yours truly up on stage. And it was a privilege because, you know, there were women who had come here from the Seychelles, from Nairobi, where they're working in informal communities. And just to see the lineup of different voices on stage was super impressive. And also just how quickly people begin to exchange ideas and seek alliances.
What are they looking for from Dubai when you talk about that, and just the idea of sustainability? That is something that could be a challenge for Dubai as well. I mean, how are they presenting themselves there to other cities, and what they can do to make their cities more sustainable?
Well, it's instructive, actually, Chris, because obviously here at Expo City, we had the big expo in 2020. Then you had COP hosted within this site just last year. And so you're kind of watching practical sustainability in action as you walk through the site, whether that's the way that the planting works, whether that's the way that the buildings that are built for one specific purpose are then reimagined to fulfill a new function. And Andrew, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that is often a narrative, which is, oh, that doesn't sound like the place to go to espouse the virtues of sustainability. But in fact, there's an incredibly engaged community here in property development, in urban planning, and there's actually a lot of really quite progressive policies that you can kind of see on the ground.
Yeah, for all of us, before we get too kind of clever about this, you know, that every city faces these challenges. And I would say the other thing is that, you know, what many of the people on these panels, they don't want northern solutions to their problems, that they realize that they're facing complexities. Take the representative, Angela, who came here from the Seychelles. She made clear that, you know, the Seychelles needs tourism. It needs to probably cut the number of people arriving. It wants to do its part about global warming. But if you turn off all tourism to the Seychelles, they'll have no money for healthcare, no money for education. So when people try and flight shame people into not going to the Seychelles, that has an impact on the health, the future of her country. So she was, you know, she was reasonably feisty about the need for engagement. And I think, yeah, Dubai has like everywhere else, some issues. But what's also interesting is a number of people who came on yesterday who've got some interesting fixes as well. And we had a company represented here called Desert Board. And they're making essentially an alternative to chipboard that's made out of the palm leaves that are cut off date palms when they're doing the harvesting and when they're caring for the trees. Normally those would have been put into landfill, left to rot. They found a way of compressing them, making them into a board that can be used as a building material. But they're just one of numerous companies that are based in Dubai that are looking at new sustainable materials. And in fact, I think that maybe there's more going on here than in some European cities.
Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for joining us here on The Globalist. Look forward to the rest of your time there in Dubai. More panels today. And that is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvini, Laura Kramer, and Tom Webb, our researcher, Neoma Akwe, and our studio manager, Steph Chungu, with editing assistance from Christy O'Grady. After the headlines, there is more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Chris Chermak. Thanks for tuning in.